Welcome to WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro, located on your local radio dial at 103.5 FM. We are an all-volunteer radio station and also a global cyber destination at www.communityradio.coop. You're listening to Wisdom Soft Whisper, a show about the true nature of wisdom. This show is a place where friends from around the world can come together via streaming audio to discover the deeper secrets of ourselves. This is your host, Trip Overholt, and with me today, as always, is the Wizard Baldur. Good morning, Wizard.
Good afternoon, Trip, and good afternoon, Leaf.
And in the studio today, returning for the third or fourth time, our friend and local naturalist, ordained priest, sacred plant investigator, Leaf Diamond, will be asking a smart question or two. On behalf of our listening audience on the path of sacred plant healing. And Chris, you're on the line, true?
I am on the line and happy to be part of this, amazing little group here.
Yeah, hi, Chris.
Hey, John. Well, long time no see you.
Yes.
And hi, Chris.
Which, is this Trip or Leaf?
This is Leaf.
Howdy.
That's Leaf. He's a naturalist, and this is Trip, your host.
Howdy.
We are very delighted to have you on the show today, and we've got a ton of questions for you.
But, okay, well, hopefully I have a ton of answers.
All right, I'm sure you will. Our special guest today, Chris Killam, is the world's did I pronounce it right? Killam?
Yes, you did.
Okay, is the world's foremost sacred and medicinal plant hunter, as well as a prolific author and educator. Dedicated to expanding the field of natural plant-based medicines, his company, Medicine Hunter Inc., is an integrated enterprise conducting expeditions and field research, TV appearances and training seminars for some of the world's largest nutraceutical, cosmetic, beverage, and food companies. Chris and his wife, Zoe?
Yes.
Travel the globe, working together to promote plant medicines, environmental protection, and cultural preservation. CNN calls Chris the Indiana Jones of natural medicine.
God bless CNN. They're here when I needed them the most. When the chips are down, the big news agencies do deliver. Oh, man.
So, Chris, you and your beautiful, highly talented, dare I say, hot wife.
Yes, you can say hot.
Jet, boat, and backpack into the most remote and exotic locales on the planet. Hang out with shamans, tasting, touching, experiencing. Oh, there's our local train. And learning things few, if any, outsiders before you have ever experienced. Then you bring it back here, and operating in the highest realms of entrepreneurism, media, and academia, serve as a bridge between the vanishing healing wisdom of the ancients and this adolescent culture of ours that is starving for wisdom and healing.
God, you are so hired.
Dude, what are you trying to do? Make our whole town jealous?
Yeah, that sort of about sums it up. I mean, I think that in truth, we don't necessarily wind up in loads of situations that nobody has encountered previously. But for sure, you know, we do get privileged access, and I think it has to do with, you know, my own sincere pursuit of, helping to establish trade with people who really want it in remote areas. And just kind of the general respect that we bring to these communities and experiences, it really matters. It matters everything how you approach people.
For sure. Now, I've got questions out the yin-yang for you, Chris, but I've got two other folks in the studio here who might want to jump in right now.
Okay.
I'm just hanging out.
Yeah.
As wizards are wont to do.
Okay. Well, this show is about the true nature of ourselves. It's really about spirituality, for lack of a better word, and there's so much that you're involved in. But we're going to keep the focus here mostly on the spiritual today.
All right.
So I'm wondering if you could just off the top share with us some of your most memorable experiences with the amazing shamans that you've spent time with.
Well, I think of a couple of almost initiatory experiences in a way. I mean, the first was around 1994 with a shaman friend who I subsequently took back home to the Amazon in 11 years. He'd been living in D.C., but when I first met him, he did a ceremony with several of us, and basically it was him sitting with a little drum and chanting and not really giving much direction of any kind. And I had a profound visionary experience, you know, unaided by any psychoactive plants. And the sort of capper of the experience was that as I was coming out of this cave in which I'd been wandering, there was a large mountain lion, and I was watching this cat go by, and I heard Ipupiara, the shaman, I heard him say, "Remember to ask for the teaching." And I turned to this huge cat, and I said, "Do you have something to tell me?" And it stopped, and it said, "You must journey to many worlds and then tell people what you saw." Yeah. And that that not only sort of kind of neatly summarizes basically the work I've been doing since, but it really got to me in a part of my psyche that was much more motivating than simply an idea. And I think the second really powerful kind of initiatory or catalytic experience was when he and I, 3 years later, stayed in the Brazilian Amazon on the river for a month with some natives that he knew. And we went to visit different shamans, and it was quite comical because the local people there were like, "Oh, why do you want to visit shamans?" And I'd say, "Well, you know, they have stuff to teach us." And they'd be like, "Really?" So we wound up having this kind of odd, lopsided entourage of all of these neighbors on the river of this family where we were staying who wanted to come along. So we rented this gigantic riverboat, and there ensued a lot of hilarity because all means of transportation break down in the most inopportune moments. But to the particular message at hand, we were chasing down a 103-year-old woman named Maria Sina, who was pretty much the shaman of the shamans in this region. And we, after days of finding her entirely too elusive, caught up with her in a pretty remote spot. And she was really delightful and completely had her wits about her and was incredibly tiny. I mean, she was probably like 4'10" and about 68 pounds. She was little. She had been desiccated by time, you know. And she said to both Ipupiara and me she wanted to do a ceremony on us. And she didn't say what, she didn't say why, she didn't say anything about it, basically. And she sat each one of us down, me first, and kind of tapped us about the head and shoulders lightly and sang this sweet little chant. And about 10 minutes after finishing with this, both of us had the experience of starting to cook at a very, very hot temperature from the inside out. And she also said other things. She looked at me and she said, "You bridge the world. You tell people about each other. This is important for you to do." She was very adamant about me needing to help foster better human understanding by talking about the different worlds to other worlds. And what happened to Ipupiara and me was that from that period of time, about 11 o'clock in the morning, until about 3 a.m. the next morning, we roasted like pigs over a spit from the inside out, and no amount of tossing ourselves in the river would help. And about 3 a.m. it broke, and we both felt startlingly cleansed and refreshed. And I think those two experiences early in my shamanic explorations were very important for setting my direction for my own personal journey and for this work.
Amazing. Well, are we in danger of losing the shamans and their sacred plants forever, or will a sufficient remnant remain to carry us through our coming trials?
Well, I think that because of the current popularization of shamanism, we're actually going to experience both. There are shamans out there who are not going to have their wisdom recorded, who are not going to have apprentices, who are not going to have all of their knowledge saved, and they'll fade into the sands of time. But we're in a period with shamanism that's very, very similar to India and gurus circa 1970, 71, 72, when all of a sudden this archaic tradition really exploded anew on the scene. And with it, of course, it had not only people were discovering real and actual gurus of worth and value and wisdom and, you know, estimable knowledge, but also a whole bunch of posers and fakers and scam artists and temporary gurus who saw opportunity to be famous, powerful, make a buck, whatever, have sex with a lot of people. And we're seeing the same thing with shamanism. So I think the good news is that we're gaining greater global recognition of the traditions of shamanism. And the bad news is we also have this, like, Mardi Gras parade of pathetics who are pretending to be shamans. And that's just typical and sad, but it's common in the marketplace.
Hmm. Leif, did you have a question for Chris?
Yeah, Chris, first I want to say thank you for the great work you're doing for the world.
Well, thank you.
I've been a psychotherapist most of my life.
Yeah.
And in recent times, I think I've been exposed to the master therapist, that entheogen ayahuasca.
Yes.
And maybe let me just pause there, and then I'll have more specific questions. But I just want to hear something about your experiences or opinion of that master healing plant.
Okay. I have the highest possible regard for ayahuasca. And I believe that of the medicines I've encountered of any sort in any country at any time for any purpose, none of them compare with ayahuasca. The last experience I had with ayahuasca a couple of months ago sort of perfectly sums up my own comments. A friend and I journeyed to Peru a lot, and we chose to go see this particular curandero who was not one of the kind of group of shamans that I typically go to for ceremony. And he was a very unusual fellow named Cesar. The point of it was that during the ceremony, rather than singing the traditional Shipibo Icaros, the songs of the spirit that they sing in that particular native group, he did this repetitive chant in Spanish. And the words basically were, there is no medicine, there is no therapy, there is no doctor, there is no treatment, there is no approach, there is no plan, there is no regimen that compares in any way, even faintly, with the greatness and the majesty of ayahuasca. And it was long and it was rhythmic and he did this for hours and it was very interesting. I think that while there are absolutely some similarities between magic mushrooms and ayahuasca and LSD and ayahuasca and hashish used as a psychedelic, you know, orally and ayahuasca, mm-hmm. It's fair to say that in my experience, I've never encountered anything A, as potent, and B, as profoundly able to go deep into every facet of my being and help me to achieve whatever it is I'm seeking in the ceremony. I mean, I had an experience, for example, years ago when, after I had grieved, in my estimation, for entirely too long after my mother's death, I went down and saw a highly distinguished shaman in Peru, drank ayahuasca with him, found myself having a very normal, friendly, non-cosmic kind of conversation with my mother, had a thoroughly enjoyable and brilliant vision-laden experience, and at the end of that evening, all sense of grief in any corner of my being, in my spirit, in my heart, in my psyche, was utterly gone and replaced by just an enduring sense of gratitude and love. So I think that ayahuasca is the great medicine. And my only concern is with the sort of stampede of ayahuasca tourists who often don't necessarily know what they're bargaining for when they go down there to drink, or worse, wind up in the company or care of someone who isn't the shaman they should be to administer a medicine that strong.
Yep.
Well said, my friend.
Thank you, sir.
Well said.
You're good.
Bless you, man.
Leif, you can have a follow-up to that, but before that, I want to let our listeners know that we're limited at the station here with just one line. The Wizard and I are going to fix this little technical problem shortly, but if you have, if you're dying to get a question to Chris, you can email me at zortacular@hotmail.com. That's zortacular@hotmail.com, and I'll get it while we're on the show here, and I'll read it, and I have one already sent that we'll get to later. Did you have a follow-up to that?
Yeah, and I wanted to say my experience, which is very limited, is nothing has seemed as much of a powerful healer as ayahuasca, even though it's been extremely difficult, and it seemed to amplify all of my most neurotic places.
Yes.
And that was really, that's been a rough part, but then one of the ways people have asked me to consider it is there's something in this plant that is looking or reaching to me, that it's not activating things inside of me, but it's a spirit medicine that really comes from outside in, and wonder what you think of that.
Well, I honestly do believe in a non-metaphorical way that ayahuasca gives us access to a spirit landscape that we do not typically have access to. And I do think that the experiences that we encounter and the things that we have happen in the ayahuasca experience are not projections of mind, or not projections of our individual minds. And so I do believe that there is something profoundly integrated, spiritually potent, luminous, deeply healing going on with ayahuasca. You know, a Hawaiian shaman once said that true healing brings into order the body, mind, and spirit with the past, present, and future. And I think that that's what ayahuasca does. There's no corner to hide from ayahuasca. Like you just described, Leif, you know, any neurosis and any goodness in ourselves will encounter that in the experience. But it gives you answers, and it heals things, physical, mental, emotional, spiritual. And I don't know anything that does that to the same extent. Although I do want to say that when you listen to people, for example, who administer or participate in like peyote rituals in the Native American church, they refer to the peyote as the medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And the people in southern Mexico who administer Los Hongos Magicos, the magic mushrooms, they call the mushrooms the medicine. And ayahuasca, too, is known as the medicine. And I think San Pedro cactus, as well, is known as the medicine. So we have these entheogens. We have these powerful, you know, hallucinogenic plants that give us access to things that do reside beyond the confines of our psyches. And this is very difficult for some people to accept.
Yes.
Yeah, and Chris, and, you know, and I call the revelations darshan, where we see the truth of our oneness.
Yes.
And the perfection of the apparition that arises in that oneness.
Yes.
And in, like in India, if you go to a guru in India, they offer, after the darshan, then they offer you something called the upadesa, whatever that work is, post-experience to help you become established in that.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that ayahuasca can help us to accomplish remarkable things, especially with regard to healing. But I agree with you that there's follow-up. You know, if you're shown a particular trait to deal with, or something in your own psyche to modify, or whatever, it's still there's still work at hand. You know, once you're normal and you're not puking into a bucket anymore.
Well, I've got a personal experience slash question for you that's kind of a follow-up to that progression from the initial experience, revelatory experience, and then later being established in some of the things that are revealed in that experience. So my first hallucinogenic experience was on psilocybin.
Yeah.
And I'm reading this, but I stood on a beach with my girlfriend, and there was this tractor beam of divine love that shot right through my heart to the center of the earth, and it held me in this state of ecstatic joy for at least like 4 hours. Tears were streaming down my face. At times I was unable and other times unwilling to even shift my feet in the sand, lest I lose that direct connection with the divine, which I had never experienced before.
Uh-huh.
Now, 25 years later, having been blessed by an awakening without drugs, I'm able to voluntarily access that same heart-cracked open sense of joy that's deep in my chest. In your opinion, were those early hallucinogenic experiences preparatory or even causative agents in my awakening? And what now do you suppose has changed in my brain or body chemistry that I'm able to feel this joy more subtly all the time? Do you is it a window or
I do believe that the reason that so many of us who started out, you know, getting high on LSD or mescaline or psilocybin wound up also practicing yoga and meditation was that those agents not only provided us with extraordinary ecstatic experiences in which we did have a palpable experience of the oneness of all things, but also, you know, kind of cracked open the otherwise sort of hardened walls of our psyches. And I think that if you fast forward decades later, if you have taken to heart the messages of these plants or these drugs, and if you have lived in a fashion that is has more regard for you know the non-separateness of us all, with our everyday behavior, which seems often so inconsequential, but just all of that over years and years, the habit, the psycho-spiritual habit of living in an integrated or a more integrated way, of course, engenders that consciousness and that state of heart. So on the one hand, I think that there's no escaping the doing the hard daily work, the every day, every week, every month, every year, every decade kind of thing. But I also do believe that these psychoactive agents kick the stones out of our beds for sure.
Mm-hmm. For sure. We've got a question from a listener, Robert Smith, a friend of mine who's at a hospital, I believe, recovering from spine surgery. Best wishes, Robert, for a speedy recovery. He says, he asks, as you know, GMOs are spreading into, and he puts nature in quotes. I would like to know Chris's views about plant spirits of pharmacologic GMOs and whether the genetics and or modification with intent to cure and heal makes that organism spirit less or more useful to work with for healing?
Okay. I am one of the people who thinks that GMOs are a bad idea because I really do believe that we don't know what the hell we're doing with those agents. So it's not that I think it's like anti-biblical or anything. I just think, you know, we have proven with any number of technologies like food irradiation and pesticides and agricultural fertilizers, et cetera, we've proven that when it comes to new technologies in agriculture, we consistently produce toxicity in the environment. So if we just kind of follow that experiential rule of thumb, I think these are bad things. Is the nature of something sort of more benign if our thoughts are generally filled with goodness or our purposes for using them are filled with goodness? You know, I think yes to a point, but this isn't, you know, we don't in fact create our own universes. You know, we all participate in this great big fat one, as multidimensional as it is, and we abide by certain rules. So if, for example, a cyanide capsule is treated with love and reverence and as an agent of healing, if somebody swallows it, they're still going to die. So I do believe that there are real limitations to how much goodness we can actually infuse into any entity or anything that is basically and fundamentally and intrinsically corrupt to start with. Is that helpful?
That's excellent. From your website, it says, Killam continually promotes sustainable principles and practices and communicates these values in a host of venues. Even if a company engages in environmentally responsible practices to benefit from green marketing, the effect is positive. The market offers room for true adherents and marketers alike. Could you comment on that?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that there are a lot of people out there who have genuinely woken up and said, wow, you know, we need to be better stewards of the environment. We need to be more wholesome in our approach to life. We can't ignore what we're doing to this world. You know, it is as though our bedroom, bathroom, living room, and kitchen are on fire while we're downstairs in the basement, you know. You know, on the one hand, I mean, I think we're really doing a vast disservice to the general environment, and some people realize that. And on the other hand, some companies say, hey, you know, there's a marketing advantage to being green. If they implement green practices and procedures just because they want a marketing advantage, I'm okay with that, as long as the practices and procedures get implemented. You know, I'd prefer it if people came to environmentally sound practices as a result of genuine good conscience. But I think that's more than we can expect from the market.
Yeah, the wizard here, he had a organic sauce and dressing manufacturing and consulting business. And
I've eaten dozens of gallons of this sauce. We all have. We've all eaten Wizard's outdoor sauce. He's the great of the great, for God's sake. We're among royalty with him when it comes to sauce. We should bow to you, John.
Easy.
Yeah.
The truth, man.
And I'm a green developer, and right now I'm proposing a model of green development in my town, but it's considered a little pricey by certain folks. And so people look at the wizard and I, and you know, anytime you step out and actually do it in the marketplace, you're going to run into flack for being something that somebody doesn't like. How do you navigate these worlds of the shamans, and then you come back and you do this amazing work here? You are trying to hold, you are incessantly insisting that companies not rip off these indigenous peoples. It's quite a balancing act.
I think that I'm by nature cheerful. I mean, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm happy-go-lucky, but I'm cheerful in that, you know, I basically have a positive outlook on life, despite my opinion that we really have royally screwed ourselves environmentally. But I think that living with positivity, living with gratitude, you know, feeling exceedingly grateful to be able to do this work. I mean, I can't describe to you what a privilege this seems to me. You know, that all helps me to move from one dimension to another fluidly, but I also think that 40 years of spiritual practice in terms of daily yoga and meditation and absolute gobs of experience with the psychoactive plants and agents overall, and you know, using healthful herbs that are, you know, non-psychoactive in ways that like strengthen my body, and living according to, you know, a lot of good health principles, I think all of this makes it easier to transition from one scene to another. I don't have time or energy or space in my psyche for jet lag. I can't afford to do that, you know. So I have to, through meditation and herbs and other things, condition myself so that I don't get jet lag, which is the case. I don't. And I think that we can toughen ourselves, if you will, so that we can accomplish things that are meaningful to us. And part of what enables me to do this work is that I have a very strong, like, real drive to accomplish some goodness as well as have a blast. And, you know, so those factors all make it easier to do this and move quickly from one scene to another. I just spent 2 weeks going from cosmetic companies in Italy where I'm trying to move herbal extracts that are sustainably sourced, you know, in the rainforest by me and my friends on behalf of huge corporations to like a conference in Morocco where I spoke about sustainable production of essential oils to, you know, I'll be going back to the Amazon. I mean, I think that doing this work absolutely demands being able to be fluid and fast and move from one world to the next, whether I'm on my back tripping with a psychedelic anaconda hovering over and then the next day I'm sitting with some academic getting more clear on the genetics of the different colors of maca. I mean, you can't get hung, you can't get stuck, you can't get caught up in any particular dimension. You've got to be able to move. That's what shamanism is. It's being able to move fluidly between worlds. And that's the hallmark of it. That's the quintessence of it. That's its main gig. That's the hub of its wheel of life.
Chris, this is Leif again. I appreciate your multidimensional approach to living with so much fullness and energy, and I hear you as ambitious, yet you seem humble. I mean, I don't know you well enough. I know when the word humble comes up, maybe in discussing it, it becomes less humble, but it does seem like you're approaching things with humility, and I wonder if you could address that.
Well, you know, I have to say that being accused of being humble isn't an experience that I have a lot.
it doesn't roll off Zoe's lips very easily, does it?
Well, you know, I think it's fair to say that it takes a certain amount of big, strong, fat ego to navigate the landscape that I do. And so, but at the same time, perhaps what you're sensing is genuine gratitude, and I think I really do know my place in the world. I mean, we are ultimately little drops of water in the great ocean of life, and I don't consider myself to be more other or different from that. So I guess in that sense, that's a dimension of humility. But, you know, one of the ways that I've been greatly aided in my attitude toward life has been to spend time around the world with people who have far less. And when I say far less, I mean, you know, may lack for basic comfort.
Uh-oh.
I think we lost. But Chris, call back in. We lost. I want to ask him about, there's some rumor, some synchronistic rumor story about Chris and a snake and his true love.
So I hope he has the radio on, or he probably doesn't have the radio on because he would have turned it off to hear himself. But we'll just have to wait for him to call back. That's never happened before. But I don't think that was a studio.
It was just sometimes the phone quits.
Yeah.
You don't know why.
His battery went dead. Not his personal battery. His phone's battery might have.
Yeah.
Any truly useful, call them for lack of better term, sacred plants that you're going to be, that are right there in our woods that you're going to be showing on your walk on Friday? Oh, there he is. I think. No. Yes. We lost you.
Yeah, I don't even know where I was. I was rambling on about life appreciation, and the next thing I knew, I was in like outer space.
We're in deep samadhi. We're having a shamanistic experience.
The psychedelic anaconda was took it.
I wound up in another dimension. So anyway,
so we want to. There's a rumor around some kind of synchronistic event with a snake and your true love and something.
Sounds like a good story.
There's a good story in there. Yeah. I want to hear.
Well, I think you might be referring to when Zoe and I went down 2 years ago to the Peruvian Amazon to be part of a gathering called Convergence. And there wound up being about 70 of us at a lodge in the forest south of Iquitos, Peru. And it got pretty woolly. There were a lot of interesting characters there. Jeremy Narby, author of Cosmic Serpent, Dennis McKenna, very well-regarded and respected researcher, and Argonaut, familiar with entheogens. A lot of talented people, maybe five shamans or so. And we, over the course of 9 days, this group of us not only had lots of workshops and music and dancing and play, but we did 3 big ayahuasca ceremonies, the last one of which was a no-holds-barred duel-to-the-death ceremony in a full moon outside on a sort of a sandy soccer area at this lodge. 70 of us on mat, 5 shamans. And it came to pass that over the course of the evening, people were staggering into the woods, and really it turned into this most remarkable, extraordinary chaos of people mad on ayahuasca and having all of the, visions and dramas and things that people have, and various of us, wandering off into the bush. And so at one point, Zoe was in one of the crude outhouses in the area, and I was sort of leaning against the door, and all around me are like people on their hands and knees barking like dogs and hanging onto trees and stuff, puking in the bushes. And Dennis McKenna, who had been in the town of Iquitos at some sort of an academic meeting, came back, and he's like, "So, how's it going?" And I'm about a foot away from him, and I looked him in the eye, and I said, "How's it look like it's going, Dennis? Take a look around." And there are people like on the ground, undulating like snakes. And it was just one of those classic moments that, we had all really gone, entirely too far. And we were not to be retrieved for hours. And Zoe and I had some pretty funny moments with it all. I think that's the thing, is that, when you do these ceremonies, I've done ceremony with friends a number of times, often there are some savagely funny moments. I mean, sometimes the shamans just start snickering and joking among themselves, and that can cause an entire, maloca of otherwise serious ayahuasca trippers to totally lose it and to be laughing until they're sobbing. So that's kind of how that went.
That's great. I had a experience at Burning Man on psilocybin, and I guess I'll share it briefly because it relates to states of consciousness.
Yes.
Well, in my head was a goddess that was emerging in various forms from and back into darkness. And when I opened my eyes on the dusty playa of Burning Man, there was this grayscale to infinity dreamscape that just unfolded. When I went back to my tent and I was nearly exhausted and I bit into this prawn that I had saved from dinner, in its flesh was like this Hubble telescope galaxy, just shimmering, purple and pink. And then I took another bite and another galaxy showed up. And then I fell asleep. I left my body and I floated out over the playa. I felt I could visit my sleeping loved ones. And then this drool slipped out of my mouth and it startled me back into my body. And Then I took another bite of shrimp, and the cycles repeated themselves over and over again. So for me, the most poignant truth revealed by that experience is that this state of consciousness we're sharing right now is no more solid or real than any of those that are experienced out there on that playa. What is your take on it, and how useful is it for someone on a spiritual path to get a taste of that?
Well, I think that if you are constructed such that you can endure, or want to participate in ceremonies with things like ayahuasca, peyote, magic mushrooms, whatever, if you're so inclined, and I think it is still a significant minority of people who actually are, then you can absolutely benefit spiritually from it. I mean, if the true realization is to recognize the oneness of life, these things will help to do that, and then that reinforces that whole consciousness and awareness when we come back into the daily circumstances that demand us to go to the post office, go to the grocery store. You know, it's like if you see people in situations through those same eyes of oneness, then in fact, these drugs, these plants, have done us enormous, incalculable spiritual service.
Yeah, my experience with ayahuasca is it seems to show me what I might be capable of, but it seems like it fades away as I get further from the experience.
Well, yes, and I think that that is typical of all of the entheogens. They are revelatory, mm-hmm. but revelations don't keep their intensity. Revelations, you know, it's not that they come and go, but the idea is that they're moments, they're dynamic, energized, profound, often unusually, you know, perceptive moments that give us access to a more integrated understanding. I mean, it's like I had an ayahuasca experience that was entirely and completely about the profound nature of love. And it wasn't that in the course of the evening I considered anything that I had never thought before. It's that the realizations went way past thinking into the deepest, you know, corners of myself. And so coming out of that, that gave me just a greater awareness of how integrated my experience of love can really be. But I don't think that these things, I mean, you can't be walking around, you know, grinning at your inner conversation with a luminous anaconda while you're driving to work. It's not gonna make your commute okay.
So what's the important thing?
Well, the important thing, I think, is integrating all these experiences. You know, it's being able to blow your top and go up the double helix and out a tunnel of infinity and into luminous realms and having these wild, dazzling, crashing experiences of oneness and spiritual unification and luminosity, and be able to come back up and still make scrambled eggs for your kids in the morning. You know, if shamanism teaches us anything, it teaches us to move flexibly, nimbly, quickly, capably, without trauma, from one situation to one country to one dimension to one scene after another after another after another. This is the flow of life.
Speaking of kids, I have a 13-year-old daughter, and she's becoming curious about drugs. I counseled her, but I won't bore you guys with that. How would you counsel your own teenage son or daughter on this topic of drugs, organic, synthetic, the revelatory nature? I mean, we're in a culture where a lot of kids are not using them in a good way. So how can you communicate some of the positive uses, but also, you know, how would you do it?
Well, I think it's a very tough thing to accomplish in our culture because parents or, you know, senior people in the lives of children are not the primary influences most of the time. But that said, I think that being open and frank and honest and not overbearing is, of course, really helpful. I know some parents whose kids, and I say kids, even, you know, age 10, have participated and do participate in ayahuasca ceremonies with absolutely no problem whatsoever. And I'm not suggesting that, you know, any parent who sort of feels like, you know, having their kids experiment wisely with drugs, that they should rush them on down to Peru and bring them through. But I am saying that you find that is also taking place. And one of the shamans that I spent a decent amount of time with, this guy Adriano, he started doing ceremony regularly when he was 8 years old. Now, he's a serious ayahuasca shaman. He's very, very devoted and smart. I think that, you know, while there aren't any perfect answers, approaching the topic with integrity and honesty, doing your absolute best to steer kids away from the crap drugs, you know, the methamphetamine, the prescription drugs, the cocaine, the stuff that can kill you.
The stupid drugs.
Yeah, the stupid drugs. And at the same time, perhaps at a certain point, even providing a safe haven for their experimental or cautionary use of certain things. You know, I remember a girlfriend a long time ago in high school whose mother was totally okay with us having sex at you know, her home. And I said, well, you know, why is this? And she said, well, she wants me to have good experiences, and she doesn't want me to have to go someplace else to have them. And the wisdom of that really kind of struck me at the time. So I think everybody, you know, on the other hand, I don't think it is healthy and productive for young kids to be doing drugs. I mean, your brain isn't really well formed, isn't fully formed until you're 20. So I don't think that, like, being a total stoner as a teenager is advisable either.
I agree.
Agreed. There are a number of wonderful people in this little town here, Carborough and environs, Silk Hope and the area where Leith lives, and some of them are on the same path as you are. Some of them are listening in, and your website, medicinehunter.com, which Zoe put together, is a really excellent website.
Nice.
And there's a page on there called the New Tribe page, where you guys are putting together people who share your vision, who are you know, into all of this. And I'm just wondering, could you talk a little about the New Tribe page and how folks listening in might be able to plug into your network through
that? Well, you know, the whole New Tribe idea, it's funny. Years ago, I arrived at a trade show with a Tahitian prince, a South Pacific diplomat, a shaman from the Amazon, a Cherokee native healing woman, and a couple of other characters. And we called ourselves the New Tribe. And we attracted all this very positive, friendly, like, high attention. And it stuck in my mind. And fast forward to the website that, as you point out, Zoe really has put together.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. We have a group called New Tribe, and the whole idea of that is to highlight people that we like and admire, with whom we have a good strong connection, who are, you know, like-minded, like-spirited, like-hearted, who really are our kind of collective conscious tribe. So that's what we're up to with that section, and it is not fully formed at present at all.
Yeah, I just pulled it up here.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
No, I think that medicinehunter.com is going to turn out to be a really wonderful hub for lots of activity, especially when it's completely fleshed out.
I do too. It's presented like this is like National Geographic level.
Zoe's obviously can write extremely well. I mean,
yes.
Every word in there is beautifully written.
Well, that's my writing. It's all her design.
He's got a long list of books, sir.
Yeah, you've written a lot of books.
Well, you know, I believe in communicating. I mean, I do a lot of TV now. I'm on Fox News someplace every day around the world. I mean, it's kind of crazy bedfellows, but You know, I do the Oz show a bunch. I'm constantly in the media because I see that the media rules our culture. And since the media rules our culture, I want the ideas that I believe in and we believe in to get some sort of a fair airing out there. And the way to do it is to participate. And so I think that medicinehunter.com is a way to participate, and all the social media, you know, networks of various types are ways to participate, and books are, and TV. And, you know, this is a time when we're able, for the first time in a long time, to talk about things like psychoactive plants in major media without ridicule. I mean, now people listen when you talk about the Johns Hopkins study on psilocybin and people having the most memorable spiritual experiences of their lives. Now people listen. I mean, Psychology Today, they did a feature on me, and I said to them, I think ayahuasca is the most, you know, basically the most powerful beneficial medicine out there, and they just put that right in there. I mean, these are changed times. So we use these tools to give us advantage to put out the message, and that's moving between worlds too.
Absolutely, and that's what we're seeing. There's a folk fellowship at large that's sharing information that transcends national identities or religious identities, and are coming together. I'm just amazed. Like when I go on Facebook and see, I mean, 30 years ago, 40 sure. years ago, you might hear one or two people of that the statue, but now they are really emerging. The little droplets are turning into a good sized puddle.
Well, and it's amazing. I mean, just consider your own show. You've got this show, and granted, geographically from a broadcast standpoint, you know, a modest area of coverage, but then you archive on the web so somebody in Caracas, Venezuela can listen to you tomorrow. And I just think, wow, you know, rather than these things being entirely fleeting as they used to be, now we can reach people with them again and again and again. You know, the link to this show will become a link on our site, and somebody will listen to that and maybe get inspired to, you know, pursue ayahuasca or not. But it's a different time, and I do believe that part of the challenge of, you know, our times is to be able to flow effortlessly between all these dimensions and just plain make it work and move forward good things.
We have about 3 more minutes, and following us will be the Full Lotus Kirtan Show with Blake Tedder. Fantastic kirtan show that Blake puts on, lasting 2 hours. Guys here in the studio, any parting thoughts?
Chris, you have addressed ecstatic experience in some ways, and I see on your book list there are things about sexuality. Would you make any comment about sexuality? Because
in 2 minutes.
the deep sexual experience.
I'll be happy to.
Let's get that 2 minutes longer.
I'll be happy to sum up one of the fundamentals of all human existence in less than 2 minutes. Sure. I think that the psychoactive plants and sex do share something in common that has been noted throughout all of the love literature. Both have the capacity to stop the mind. And, you know, when you look at the different things that people do or engage in to produce heightened states, drumming, dancing, psychoactive plants, tantric sex, you know, surfing, by God, you know, certain things, fire walking, you can't walk fire and not have every thought in your head obliterated. And, you know, unless you're just like a hopeless text messenger or something, you can't have an orgasm and, like, keep all of your, you know, thought intact. It's this sort of, it's this consciousness-busting experience. And so there's a dimension of losing the self for a time and emerging, and I think that, you know, I think there are lessons to learn from our sexual and intimate engagement that are very similar to the lessons that we learn from drinking something rugged like ayahuasca in the forest.
Thank you.
Chris, we've really enjoyed this. We hope
this has been great.
You'll come back and join us again sometime.
Only if you ask me to. Otherwise, I'm drawing a hard bargain here. Now, listen, you guys, I just want to, look, Tripp, John, Leaf, I want to thank you all. You know, you're really thoughtful. I love the conversation we've had. Bless you all. Love your show. And let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, right. And let's say again your website, medicinehunter.org.
Medicinehunter.com.
Yeah.
And, you know, once you have this link set up, just shoot it off to us. We'll, of course, put it up, embellish it with, you know, bunting, and have a parade.
Okay.
All right. Bless you all. Thanks so much.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care, guys.
All right. Bye.
Bye.